The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the 16th reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. I'm Jim Abate. Before we begin, let me explain that the book is read in its entirety and that some of the reading may contain explicit descriptions that some people could find objectionable. If you didn't hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In our last reading, Etienne survived the accidental bombing of his prison in Fort National. On the 12th of August, Marie-Laure finished her broadcasts of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, while Von Rumpel is visited by a corporal who informs him that the city is being evacuated, and at noon the following day there will be a ceasefire to allow the civilians to get out. Werner heard Marie-Laure's final broadcast. On the 13th, Marie-Laure has been in the attic for 5 days. No water for a day and a half, no food for 2 days. She plays the piano record as loud as it will go. In the Hotel of Bees, Werner had left the headphones on Volkheimer's ears, and Volkheimer hears the music, becomes alert, builds a barricade where the stairs used to be, and throws a grenade into it. The grenade creates a small opening to the outside. Volkheimer and Werner escape into an alley. He gave Volkheimer the rifle and went to find food. Werner went to number 4 Rue Vaubernier, and as Von Rumpel is about to go into the wardrobe, Werner entered the house. When Von Rumpel aimed his gun at Werner, he heard Marie-Laure coming through the wardrobe and dropped his guard, and Werner reached for the rifle. When Marie-Laure exited the wardrobe, Werner told her he had heard her on the radio and came to help her. They opened the last can from the basement and shared the peaches inside. When the bombing stopped, Werner and Marie-Laure went to the grotto where Marie-Laure threw the sea of flames into the water, as we now continue with All the Light We Cannot See. She climbs out, breathless, pushes him back through the gate and locks it behind them. He hands her the cane. Then they head back down the alley, her shoes squelching as she goes. Out through the hanging ivy, turn left, straight ahead, a ragged stream of people crosses an intersection. A woman, a child, two men carrying a third on a stretcher, all three with cigarettes in their mouths. The darkness returns to Werner's eyes, and he feels faint. Soon his legs will give out. A cat sits in the road, licking a paw and smoothing it over its ears and watching him. He thinks of the old broken miners he'd see in Zollverein, sitting in chairs or on crates, not moving for hours, waiting to die. To men like that, time was a surfeit, a barrel they watched slowly drain. When really, he thinks, it's a glowing puddle you carry in your hands. You should spend all your energy protecting it, fighting for it, working so hard not to spill one single drop. Now, he says in the clearest French he can muster, here's the pillowcase. You run your hand along that wall. Can you feel it? You'll reach an intersection. Keep going straight. The street looks mostly clear. Keep the pillowcase high, right out in front like this. Do you understand? She turns to him and chews her bottom lip. They will shoot? Not with that white flag. Not a girl. There are others ahead. Follow this wall. He sets her hand against it a second time. Hurry, remember the pillowcase. And you? I will go in the other direction. She turns her face toward his, and though she cannot see him, he feels he cannot bear her gaze.
Won't you come with me?
It will be better for you if no one sees you with me.
But how will I find you again?
I don't know. She reaches for his hand, sets something in his palm, and squeezes his hand into a fist.
Goodbye, Werner.
Goodbye, Marie-Laure. Then she goes. Every few paces, the tip of her cane strikes a broken stone in the street. and it takes a while to pick her way around it. Step, pause, step, step again, her cane testing, the wet hem of her dress swinging, the white pillowcase held aloft. He does not look away until she is through the intersection, down the next block, and out of sight. He waits to hear voices, guns. They will help her. They must. When he opens his hand, there is a little iron key in his palm. Chocolate. Madame Rouet finds Marie-Laure that evening in a requisition school. She grips her hand and does not let go. The civil affairs people have stacks of confiscated German chocolate in rectangular cartons, and Marie-Laure and Madame Rouet eat too many to count. In the morning, the Americans take the chateau and the last anti-air battery and free the prisoners held at Fort National. Madame Rouet pulls Etienne out of the processing queue, and he wraps Marie-Laure in his arms. The colonel in his underground fortress across the river holds out for 3 more days until an American airplane, called a Lightning, drops a tank of napalm through an air vent, 1 shot in a million, and 5 minutes later, a white sheet comes up on a pole, and the siege of St. Malo is over. Sweep platoons remove all the incendiary devices they can find, and army photographers go in with their tripods, and a handful of citizens return from farms and fields and cellars to drift through the ruined streets. On August 25th, Madame Rouet is allowed back into the city to check on the condition of the bakery. But Etienne and Marie-Laure travel in the other direction, toward Rennes, when they book a room at a hotel called the Universe with a functioning boiler, and each takes a 2-hour bath. In the window glass as night falls, he watches her reflection feel its way toward the bed. Her hands press against her face, then fall away. "We'll go to Paris," he says. "I've never been. You can show it to me." Light. Werner is captured a mile south of St. Malo by 3 French resistance fighters in street clothes roving the streets in a lorry. First, they believe they have rescued a little white-haired old man. Then they hear his accent, notice the German tunic beneath the antique shirt, and decide they have a spy, a fabulous catch. Then they realize Werner's youth. They hand him off to an American clerk in a requisitioned hotel transformed to a disarmament center. At first, Werner worries they're taking him downstairs. Please, not another pit. But he is brought to the 3rd floor, where an exhausted interpreter who has been booking German prisoners for a month notes his name and rank, then asks a few rote questions while the clerk rifles through Werner's canvas duffel and hands it back. "A girl," Werner says in French. "Did you see?" But the interpreter only smirks and says something to the clerk in English, as though every German soldier he has interviewed has asked about a girl. He's ushered into a courtyard encircled with razor wire, where 8 or 9 other Germans sit in their high boots, holding battered canteens, one dressed in women's clothes in which he apparently tried to desert, 2 NCOs, and 3 privates, and no Volkheimer. At night, they serve soup in a cauldron, and he gulps down 4 helpings from a tin cup. 5 minutes later, he is sick in the corner. The soup won't stay down in the morning either. Shoals of clouds swim through the sky. His left ear admits no sound. He lingers over images of Marie-Laure, her hands, her hair, even as he worries that to concentrate on them too long is to risk wearing them out. A day after his arrest, he is marched east in a group of 20 to join a larger group, where they are penned in a warehouse. Through the open doors, he cannot see St. Malo, but he hears the airplanes, hundreds of them, and a great pall of smoke hangs over the horizon day and night. 2 medics try giving Werner bowls of gruel, but it will not stay down. He's been able to keep nothing in his stomach since the peaches. Maybe his fever is returning. Maybe the sludge they drank in the hotel cellar has poisoned him. Maybe his body is giving up. If he does not eat, he understands, he will die. But when he does eat, he feels as if he will die. From the warehouse, they are marched to Dinan. Most of the prisoners are boys or middle-aged men, the shattered remains of companies. They carry ponchos, duffels, crates, a few tote brightly colored suitcases claimed from who knows where. Among them walk pairs of men who fought side by side, but most are strangers to one another, and all have seen things they wish to forget. Always there is the sense of a tide behind them, rising, gathering mass, carrying with it a slow and vindictive rage. He walks in the tweed trousers of Marie-Laure's great-uncle. Over his shoulder he carries his duffel. 18 years old. All his life, his schoolmasters, his radio, his leaders talk to him about the future. And yet, what future remains? The road ahead is blank, and the lines of his thoughts all incline inward. He sees Marie-Laure disappear down the street, with her cane like ash blown out of a fire, and a feeling of longing crashes against the underside of his ribs. On the 1st of September, Bernard cannot get to his feet when he wakes. Two of his fellow prisoners help him to the bathroom and back, then lay him in the grass. A young Canadian in a medic's helmet shines a penlight into Werner's eyes and loads him into a truck, and he is driven some distance and set in a tent full of dying men. A nurse puts fluid into his arm, spoons a solution into his mouth. For a week, he lives in the strange greenish light beneath the canvas of that huge tent, his duffel clutched in one hand and the hard corners of the little wooden house clamped in the other. When he has the strength, he fiddles with it, twists the chimney, slide off the three panels of the roof, look inside, built so cleverly. Every day, on his right and left, another soul escapes toward the sky, and it sounds to him as if he can hear faraway music, as if a door has been shut on a grand old radio, and he can listen only by putting his good ear against the material of his cot. Although the music is soft, then there are moments when he is not certain it is there at all. There is something to be angry at, Werner is sure, but he cannot say what it is. "Won't eat," says a nurse in English. Armband of medic. "Fever?" "Hi." There are more words than numbers. In a dream, he sees a bright crystalline night with the canals all frozen and the lanterns of the miners' houses burning and the farmers skating between the fields. He sees a submarine asleep in the lightless depths of the Atlantic. Jutta presses her face to a porthole and breathes on the glass. He half expects to see Volkheimer's huge hand appear, help him up, and clap him into the opal. And Marie-Laure, can she still feel the pressure of his hand against the webbing between her fingers as he can feel hers? One night he sits up. In cots around him are a few dozen sick or wounded. A warm September wind pours across the countryside and sets the walls of the tent rippling. Werner's head swivels lightly on his neck. The wind is strong and gusting stronger, and the corners of the tent strain against their guy ropes, and where the flaps at the two ends come up, he can see trees buck and sway. Everything rustles. Werner zips his old notebook and the little house into his duffel, and the man beside him murmurs questions to himself, and the rest of the ruined company sleeps. Even Werner's thirst has faded. He feels only the raw, impassive surge of the moonlight as it strikes the tent above him and scatters. Out there, through the open flaps of the tent, clouds hurtle above the treetops, toward Germany, toward home. Silver and blue, blue and silver. Sheets of paper tumble down the rows of cots and in Werner's chest comes a quickening. He sees Frau Elena kneel beside the coal stove and bank up the fire. Children in their beds. Baby Jutta sleeps in her cradle. His father lights a lamp, steps into an elevator, and disappears. The voice of Volkheimer, "What you could be!" Werner's body seems to have gone weightless under his blanket, and beyond the flapping tent doors, the trees dance and the clouds keep up their huge billowing march, and he swings first one leg and then the other off the edge of the bed. "Ernst," says a man beside him. "Ernst?" But there is no Ernst. The men in the cots do not reply. The American soldier at the door of the tent sleeps. Werner walks past him into the grass. The wind moves through his undershirt. He is a kite, a balloon. Once, he and Jutta built a little sailboat from scraps of wood and carried it to the river. Jutta painted the vessel in ecstatic purples and greens, and she set it on the water with great formality. But the boat sagged as soon as the current got hold of it. It floated downstream, out of reach, and the flat black water swallowed it. Jutta blinked at Werner with wet eyes, pulling at the battered loops of yarn in her sweater. "It's all right," he told her. "Things hardly ever work on the first try. We'll make another, a better one." Did they? He hopes they did. He seems to remember a little boat, a more seaworthy one, gliding down a river. It sailed around a bend and left them behind, didn't it? The moonlight shines in billows. The broken clouds scud above the trees. Leaves fly everywhere. But the moonlight stays unmoved by the wind, passing through clouds, through air, in what seems to Werner like impossibly slow, imperturbable rays. They hang across the buckling grass. Why doesn't the wind move the light? Across the field, an American watches a boy leave the sick tent and move against the background of the trees. He sits up. He raises his hand. "Stop!" he calls. "Halt!" he calls. But Werner has crossed the edge of the field, where he steps on a trigger landmine set there by his own army 3 months before, and disappears in a fountain of earth. 11. 1945. Berlin. In January 1945, Frau Elena and the last four girls living at Children's House, the twins, Hanna and Suzanne Gerlitz, Claudia Forster, and 15-year-old Jutta Fenning, are transported from Essen to Berlin to work in a machine parts factory. For 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, they disassemble massive forging presses and stack the usable metal in crates to be loaded into train cars. Unscrewing, sawing, hauling. Most days, Frau Elena works close by, wearing a torn ski jacket she has found, mumbling to herself in French or singing songs from childhood. They live above a printing company abandoned a month before. Hundreds of crates of misprinted dictionaries are stacked in the halls, and the girls burn them page by page in the potbelly stove. Yesterday, Dankswort, Dankswörte, Dank Gilbert, Dank Opfer. Today, Frauenverband, Frauenverein, Frauenverster, Frauenwahrheit. For meals, they have cabbage and barley in the factory canteen at noon. Endless ration lines in the evening. Butter is cut into tiny portions. 3 times a week, they each get a square half the size of a sugar cube. Water comes from a spigot 2 blocks away. Mothers with infants have no baby clothes, no buggies, and very little cow's milk. Some tear apart bed sheets for diapers. A few find newspapers and fold those into triangles and pin them between their baby's legs. At least half of the girls working in the factory cannot read or write. So Jutta reads them the letters that come from boyfriends or brothers or fathers at the front. Sometimes she writes responses for them.
And do you remember when we ate pistachios, when we ate those lemon ices shaped like flowers, when you said...
All spring the bombers come every single night, their only goal seemingly to burn the city to its roots. Most nights the girls hurry to the end of the block and climb into a cramped shelter and are kept awake by the crashing of stonework. Once in a while on the walk to the factory, they see bodies, mummies turned to ash, people scorched beyond recognition. Other times, the corpses bear no apparent injuries, and it is these that fill Jutta with dread. People who look like they are a moment away from rising up and slogging back to work with the rest of them. But they do not wake. Once she sees a row of three children face down, backpacks on their backs. Her first thought is, wake up, go to school. Then she thinks, there could be food in those packs. Claudia Forster stops talking. Whole days pass and she does not say a word. The factory runs out of materials. There are rumors that no one is in charge anymore, that the copper and zinc and stainless steel they've been slaving to collect is being loaded onto train cars and left on sidings for no one. Mail stops. In late March, the machine parts factory is padlocked, and Frau Elena and the girls are sent to work for a civilian firm cleaning the streets after bombings. They lift broken masonry blocks, shovel dust and shattered glass through strainers. Jutta hears about boys, 16 and 17-year-olds, terrified, homesick, with trembling eyes, who show up on the doorsteps of their mothers only to be hauled howling out of the attics 2 days later and shot in the street as deserters. Images from her childhood, riding in a wagon behind her brother, picking through trash, return to her, looking to salvage one shining thing from the mire.
Verna, she whispers aloud.
In the fall, at Zollverein, she received two letters announcing his death. Each mentioned a different place of burial. La Fresnaye, Cherbourg. She had to look them up. Towns in France. Sometimes, in dreams, she stands with him over a table, strewn with gears and belts and motors.
I'm making something, he says. I'm working on it.
But he doesn't go on. By April, the women speak only of the Russians and the things they will do, the vengeance they will seek. Barbarians, they say. Tatters, Ruskies, savages, swine. The pigs are in Strasbourg. The ogres are in the suburbs. Hanna, Suzanne, Claudia, and Jutta sleep on the floor in a tangle. Does any goodness linger in this last derelict stronghold? A little. Jutta comes home one afternoon, pasted with dust, to discover that big Claudia Forster has chanced upon a paper bakery box sealed with gold tape. Blots of grease show through the cardboard. Together the girls stare at it, like something from the unfallen world. Inside wait 15 pastries, separated by squares of wax paper and stuffed with strawberry preserves. The four girls and Frau Elena sit in their dripping apartment, a spring rain over the city, all the ash running off the ruins, all the rats peering out of caves made from fallen bricks, and they eat three stale pastries each, none of them saving anything for later. The powdered sugar on their noses, the jelly between their teeth, a giddiness rising and sparkling in their blood. That cow-like, petrified Claudia could achieve such a miracle that she would be good enough to share it. What young women are left dress themselves in rags, cower in basements. Jutta hears that grandmothers are rubbing granddaughters with feces, sawing off their hair with bread knives, anything to make them less appealing to the Russians. She hears mothers are drowning daughters. She hears you can smell the blood on them from a mile away.
"Not much longer now," says Frau Elena, her palms out in front of the stove as the water refuses to boil.
The Russians come for them on a cloudless day in May. There are only three of them, and they come only one at a time. They break into the printing company below, hunting liquor, but find none, and are soon bashing holes in the walls. A crack and a shutter, a bullet zinging off an old dismantled press. And in the upstairs apartment, Frau Elena sits in her striped ski parka and abridged New Testament zipped into the pocket, holding the hands of the girls and moving her lips in soundless prayer. Jutta allows herself to believe that they won't come up the staircase. For several minutes, they don't, until they do and their boots thump all the way up.
"Stay calm," Frau Elena tells the girls.
Hannah and Suzanne and Claudia and Jutta, none of them is older than 16. Frau Elena's voice is low and deflated, but it does not seem afraid. Disappointed, maybe.
"Stay calm, and they won't shoot. I'll make sure to go first. After that, they'll be gentler."
Jutta laces her hands behind her head to keep them from shaking. Claudia seems mute, deaf.
"And close your eyes," says Frau Elena.
Hannah sobs. Jutta says, "I want to see them."
"Keep them open then."
The footsteps stop at the top of the stairwell. The Russians go into the closet, and they hear the handles of mops being kicked drunkenly, and a crate of dictionaries go thudding down the stairs, and then someone rattles the knob. One says something to another, and the jam splinters, and the door bangs open. One is an officer. Two cannot be a day older than 17. All are filthy beyond comprehension, but somewhere in the previous hours they have taken the liberty of splashing themselves with women's perfume. The two boys in particular smell toxically of it. They seem partly like sheepish schoolboys and partly like lunatics with an hour left to live. The first has only a rope for a belt and is so thin he does not have to unknot it to slide off his trousers. The second laughs, a strange, puzzled laugh, as if he does not quite believe the Germans would come to his country and leave a city like this behind. The officer sits by the door with his legs straight out in front of him and peers out into the street. Hannah screams for half a second, but quickly muffles it with her own hand. Frau Elena leads the boys into the other room. She makes a single noise, a cough, as though she had something stuck in her throat. Claudia goes next. She offers up only moans. Jutta does not allow herself to make a single sound. Everything is strangely orderly. The officer goes last, trying each of them in turn, and he speaks single words while he's on top of Jutta, his eyes open but not seeing. It is not clear from his compressed, pained face if the words are endearments or insults. Beneath the cologne, he smells like a horse. Years later, Jutta will hear the words he spoke repeated in her memory. Kirill, Pavel, Afanasy, Valentin, and she will decide they were the names of dead soldiers. But she could be wrong. Before the Russians leave, the youngest fires his weapon into the ceiling twice, and the plaster rains gently down on Jutta, and in the loud reverberating echo, she can hear Suzanne on the floor beside her, not sobbing, but merely breathing very quietly as she listens to the officer buckle himself back up. Then the three men spill into the street, and Frau Elena zips herself into her ski parka, barefoot, rubbing her left arm with her right hand as if trying to warm that one small segment of herself. Paris. ATM rents the same flat on the Rue des Patriarches where Marie-Laure grew up. He buys the newspapers every day to scan the lists of released prisoners and listens incessantly to one of three radios. De Gaulle this, North Africa that, Hitler, Roosevelt, Danzig, Bratislava, all these names, none of them her father's. Every morning they walk to the Gare d'Auschwitz to wait. A big station clock rattles off a relentless advance of seconds, and Marie-Laure sits beside her great-uncle and listens to the wasted and wretched shamble of the trains. Etienne sees soldiers with hollows in their cheeks like inverted cups, 30-year-olds who look 80, men in threadbare suits putting hands to the top of their heads to take off hats that are no longer there. Marie-Laure deduces what she can from the sounds of their shoes. Those are small. Those weigh a ton. Those hardly exist at all. In the evenings, she reads while Etienne makes phone calls, petitions repatriation authorities, and writes letters. She finds she can sleep only 2 or 3 hours at a time. Phantom shells wake her. "It is merely the autobus," says Etienne, who takes to sleeping on the floor beside her, or, "It's just the birds," or, "It's nothing, Marie." Most days, the creaky old malacologist, Dr. Giffard, waits with them at the Gare d'Auschwitz, sitting upright with his beard and bow tie, smelling of rosemary, of mint, of wine. He calls her Lorette. He talks about how he missed her, how he thought of her every day, how to see her is to believe once more that goodness, more than anything else, is what lasts. She sits with her shoulder pressed against Etienne's or Dr. Giffard's. Papa might be anywhere. He might be that voice just now drawing nearer, those footfalls to her right. He might be in a cell, in a ditch, 1,000 miles away. He might be long dead. She goes into the museum on Etienne's arm to talk with various officials, many of whom remember her. The director himself explains that they are searching as hard as they can for her father, that they will continue to help with her housing, her education. There is no mention of the Sea of Flames. Spring unfurls. Communiques flood the airwaves. Berlin surrenders. Göring surrenders. The great mysterious vault of Nazism falls open. Parades materialize spontaneously. The others who wait at the Gare d'Austerlitz whisper that 1 out of every 100 will come back, that you can loop your thumb and forefinger around their necks, that when they take off their shirts, you can see their lungs moving inside their chests. Every bite of food she takes is a betrayal. Even those who have returned, she can tell, have returned different, older than they should be, as though they have been on another planet where years pass more quickly. "There is a chance," Etienne says, "that we will never find out what happened. We have to be prepared for that." Marie-Laure hears Madame Manek, "You must never stop believing." All through the summer they wait, Etienne always on one side, Dr. Giffard often on the other, and then, one noon in August, Marie-Laure leads her great-uncle and Dr. Giffard up the long stairs and out into the sunlight and ask if it is safe to cross. They say it is, so she leads them along the quay through the gates of the Jardin des Plantes. Along the gravel paths boys shout. Someone not far away plays a saxophone. She stops beside an arbor alive with the sound of bees. The sky seems high and far away. Somewhere, someone is figuring out how to push back the hood of grief, but Marie-Laure cannot. Not yet. The truth is that she is a disabled girl with no home and no parents. "What now?" asks Etienne.
"Blanche?" "School," she says. "I would like to go to school."
12. 1974. Bockheimer. Frank Bockheimer's third-floor walk-up in the suburbs of Pforzheim, Germany, possesses three windows. A single billboard mounted on the cornice of the building across the alley dominates the view. Its surface gleams 3 yards beyond the glass. Printed on it are processed meats, cold cuts as tall as he is, reds and pinks, gray at the edges, garnished with parsley sprigs the size of shrubs. At night, the billboard's 4 cheerless electric spotlights bathe his apartment in a strange reflected glare. He is 51 years old. April rain falls slantwise through the billboard spotlights, and Bockheimer's television flickers blue, and he ducks habitually as he passes through the doorway between his kitchen and the main room. No children, no pets, no houseplants, few books on the shelves, just a card table, a mattress, and a single armchair in front of the television where he now sits, a tin of butter cookies in his lap. He eats them one after another, all the floral discs, then the ones shaped like pretzels, and finally the clovers. On the television, a black horse helps free a man trapped beneath a fallen tree. Bockheimer installs and repairs rooftop TV antennas. He puts on a blue jumpsuit every morning, faded where it strains over his huge shoulders, too short around the ankles, and walks to work in big black boots. Because he is strong enough to move the big extension ladders by himself, and perhaps also because he rarely speaks, Bockheimer responds to most calls alone. People telephone the branch office to request an installation or to complain about ghost signals, interference, starlings on the wires, and out goes Bockheimer. He splices a broken line or pokes a bird's nest off a boom or elevates an antenna on struts. Only on the windiest, coldest days does Pforzheim feel like home. Bockheimer likes feeling the air slip under the collar of his jumpsuit, likes seeing the light blown clear by the wind, the far-off hills powdered with snow, the town's trees, all planted in the years after the war, all the same age, glittering with ice. On winter afternoons, he moves among the antennas like a sailor through rigging. In the late blue light, he can watch the people in the streets below, hurrying home, and sometimes gulls soar past, white against the dark. The small, secure weight of tools along his belt, the smell of intermittent rain, and the crystalline brilliance of the clouds at dusk. These are the only times when Bockheimer feels marginally whole. But on most days, especially the warm ones, life exhausts him. The worsening traffic and graffiti in company politics, everyone grousing about bonuses, benefits, overtime. Sometimes in the slow heat of summer, long before dawn, Bockheimer paces in the harsh dazzle of the billboard lights and feels his loneliness on him like a disease. He sees tall ranks of firs swaying in a storm, hears their heartwood groan. He sees the earthen floor of his childhood home and the spider-webbed light of dawn coming through conifers. Other times, the eyes of men who are about to die haunt him, and he kills them all over again. Dead man in Lodz, dead man in Lublin, Dead man in Radom. Dead man in Krakow. Rain on the windows, rain on the roof. Before he goes to bed, Volkheimer descends 3 flights of stairs to the atrium to check his mail. He has not checked his mail in over a week, and among 2 flyers and a paycheck and a single utility bill is a small package from a veterans service organization located in West Berlin. He carries the mail upstairs and opens the package. 3 different objects have been photographed against the same white background, carefully numbered note cards taped beside each. 14-6962, a canvas soldier's bag, mouse gray, with 2 padded straps. 14-6963, a little model house made from wood, partially crushed. 14-6964, a soft, covered, rectangular notebook with a single word across the front, Fragen. The house he does not recognize, and the bag could have been any soldier's, but he knows the notebook instantly. WP inked on the bottom corner. Volkheimer sets 2 fingers on the photograph as though he could pluck out the notebook and sift through its pages. He was just a boy. They all were, even the largest of them. The letter explains that the organization is trying to deliver items to next of kin of dead soldiers whose names have been lost. It says they believe that he, Staff Sergeant Frank Volkheimer, served as ranking officer of a unit that included the owner of this bag, a bag that was collected by a United States Army prisoner of war processing camp in Bernay, France, in the year 1944. Does he know to whom these items belonged? He sets the photographs on the table and stands with his big hands at his sides. He hears jouncing axles, grumbling tailpipes, rain on canvas, clouds of gnats buzzing, the march of jackboots, and the full-throated shouts of boys. Static, then the guns. But was it decent to leave him out there like that, even after he was dead? But you could be. He was small. He had white hair and ears that stuck out. He buttoned the collar of his jacket up around his throat when he was cold and drew his hands up inside the sleeves. Volkheimer knows whom these items belong to. Jutta. Jutta Vette teaches sixth-form algebra in Essen. Integers, probability, parabolas. Every day she wears the same outfit. Black slacks with a nylon blouse, alternately beige, charcoal, or pale blue. Occasionally the canary yellow one, if she's feeling unrestrained. Her skin is milky, and her hair remains white as paper. Jutta's husband, Albert, is a kind, slow-moving, and balding accountant, whose great passion is running model trains in the basement. For a long time, Jutta believed she could not get pregnant, and then, one day, when she was 37 years old, she did. Their son, Max, is 6, fond of mud, dogs, and questions no one can answer. More than anything lately, Max likes to fold complicated designs of paper airplanes. He comes home from school, kneels on the kitchen floor, and forms airplane after airplane with unswerving, almost frightening devotion, evaluating different wingtips, tails, noses, mostly seeming to love the paraxis of it, the transformation of something flat into something that can fly. It's a Thursday afternoon in early June, the school year nearly over, and they're at the public swimming pool. Slate-colored clouds veil the sky, and children shout in the shallow end, and parents talk or read magazines or doze in their chairs, and everything is normal. Albert stands at the snack counter in his swim trunks, with his little towel draped over his wide back, and contemplates his selection of ice cream. Max swims awkwardly, windmilling one arm forward and then another, periodically looking up to make sure his mother is watching. When he's done, he wraps himself in a towel and climbs into the chair beside her. Max is compact and small, and his ears stick out. Water droplets shine in his eyelashes. Dusk seeps down through the overcast, and a slight chill drops into the air, and one by one families leave to walk or bike or ride the bus home. Max plucks crackers out of a cardboard box and crunches them loudly.
"I love Leibniz-Zoo crackers, Mutti," he says.
"I know, Max." Albert drives them home in their little NSU Prinz 4, the clutch rattling, and Jutta takes a stack of end-of-term exams from her school bag and grades them at the kitchen table. Albert puts on water for noodles and fries onions. Max takes a clean sheet of paper from the drawing table and starts to fold. On the front door come knocks, three. For reasons Jutta does not fully understand, her heartbeat begins to thud in her ears. The point of her pencil hovers over a page. It's only someone at the door, a neighbor or a friend, or the little girl Anna from down the street, who sits upstairs with Max sometimes and gives him directions for how to best construct elaborate towns out of plastic blocks. But the knock does not sound anything like Anna's. Max bounds to the door, airplane in hand.
"Who is it, dear?"
Max does not reply, which means it is someone he does not know. She crosses into the hall, and there in her doorframe stands a giant. Max crosses his arms, intrigued and impressed, his airplane on the ground at his feet. The giant takes off his cap. His massive head shines.
"Frau Wette."
He wears a tent-sized silver sweatsuit with maroon splashes along the sides, zipper pulled to the base of his throat. Gingerly, he presents a faded canvas duffel bag. The bullies in the square, Hans and Herbert, his very size invokes them all. This man has come, she thinks, to other doors and not bothered to knock.
"Yes? Your maiden name was Fanning?"
Before she nods, before he says, "I have something for you." Before she invites him through the screen door, she knows this will be about Werner. The giant's nylon pants swish as he follows her down the hall. When Albert looks up from the stove, he startles, but only says,
"Hello,"
and "Watch your head," and waves his cooking spoon as the giant dodges the light fixture. When he offers dinner, the giant says yes. Albert pulls the table away from the wall and sets a fourth place. In his wooden chair, Volkheimer reminds Jutta of an image from one of Max's picture books, an elephant squeezed into an airplane seat. The duffel bag he has brought waits on the hall table. The conversation begins slowly. He has come several hours on the train. He walked here from the station. He does not need sherry, thank you. Max eats fast, Albert slowly. Jutta tucks her hands beneath her thighs to hide their shaking.
"Once they had the address," Volkheimer says, "I asked if I might deliver it myself. They included a letter, see?"
He takes a folded sheet of paper from his pocket. Outside, cars pass. Wrens trill. A part of Jutta does not want to take the letter, does not want to hear what this huge man has traveled a long way to say. Weeks go by when Jutta does not allow herself to think of the war, of Frau Elena, of the awful last months in Berlin. Now she can buy pork 7 days a week. Now, if the house feels cold, she twists the dial in the kitchen. And voila! She does not want to be one of those middle-aged women who think of nothing but her own painful history. Sometimes she looks at the eyes of her older colleagues and wonders what they did when the electricity was out, when there were no candles, when the rain came through the ceiling, what they saw. Only rarely does she loosen the seals enough to allow herself to think of Werner. In many ways, her memories of her brother have become things to lock away. A math teacher at Helmholtz Gymnasium in 1974 does not bring up a brother who attended the National Political Institute of Education at Schopforta. Albert says, "In the East, then?" Bockheimer says, "I was with him at school, then out in the field. We were in Russia, also Poland, Ukraine, Austria, then France." Max crunches a sliced apple. He says, "How tall are you?" "Max," says Jutta. Bockheimer smiles. Albert says, "He was very bright, wasn't he, Jutta's brother?" Bockheimer says, "Very." Albert offers a second helping, offers salt, offers sherry again. Albert is younger than Jutta, and during the war, he ran as a courier in Hamburg between bomb shelters, 9 years old in 1945, still a child. "The last place I saw him," says Bockheimer, "was in a town on the northern coast of France called Saint-Malo." From the loam of Jutta's memory rises a sentence. "What I want to write about today is the sea." "We spent a month there. I think he might have fallen in love." Jutta sits straighter in her chair. It's embarrassingly plain how inadequate language is. A town on the northern coast of France. Love. Nothing will be healed in this kitchen. Some griefs can never be put right. Bockheimer pushes back from the table. "It was not my intention to upset you," he hovers, dwarfing them. "It's all right," says Albert. "Max, can you please take our guest to the patio? I'll put out some cake." Max slides open the glass door for Bockheimer, and he ducks through. Jutta sets the plates in the sink. She is suddenly very tired. She only wants the big man to leave and to take the bag with him. She only wants a tide of normality to wash in and cover everything again. Albert touches her elbow. "Are you all right?" Jutta does not nod or shake her head, but slowly drags a hand over both eyebrows. "I love you, Jutta." When she looks out the window, Bockheimer is kneeling on the cement beside Max. Max lays down two sheets of paper, and although she cannot hear them, she can see the huge man talking Max through a set of steps. Max watches intently, turning over the sheet when Bockheimer turns it over, matching his folds, wetting one finger and running it along a crease. Soon enough, they each have a wide-winged plane with a long forked tail. Bockheimer sails neatly out across the yard, flying straight and true, and smacks into the fence, nose first. Max claps. Max kneels on the patio in the dusk, going over his airplane, checking the angle of its wings. Bockheimer kneels beside him, nodding, patient. Jutta says, "I love you too." Duffel. Bockheimer is gone. The duffel waits on the hall table. She can hardly look at it. Jutta helps Max into his pajamas and kisses him good night. She brushes her teeth, avoiding herself in the mirror, and goes back downstairs and stands looking out through the window in their front door. In the basement, Albert is running his trains through his meticulously painted world, beneath the underpass, over his electric drawbridge. It's a small sound up here, but relentless, a sound that penetrates the timbers of the house. Jutta brings the duffel up to the desk in her bedroom and sets it down on the floor and grades another of her students' exams, then another. She can hear the train stop, then resume their monotonous drone.
She tries to grade a third exam, but cannot concentrate. The numbers drift across the pages and collect at the bottom in unintelligible piles. She sets the bag in her lap. When they were first married and Albert went away on trips for work, Jutta would wake in the pre-dawn hours and remember those first nights after Werner left for Schopforta and feel all over again the searing pain of his absence. For something so old, the zipper on the duffel opens smoothly. Inside is a thick envelope and a package covered in a newspaper. When she unwraps the newspaper, she finds a model house, tall and narrow, no bigger than her fist. The envelope contains the notebook she sent him 40 years before, his book of questions, that crimped tiny cursive, each letter sloping slightly farther uphill. Drawings, schematics, pages of lists, something that looks like a blender powered by bicycle pedals. A motor for a model airplane. Why do some fish have whiskers? Is it true that all cats are gray when the candles are out? When lightning strikes the sea, why don't all the fish die? After 3 pages, she has to close the notebook. Memories cartwheel out of her head and tumble across the floor. Werner's cot in the attic, the wall above it papered over with her drawings of imaginary cities, the first aid box and the radio and the wire threaded out the window and through the eave. Downstairs, the trains run through Albert's 3-level layout, and in the next room, her son wages battles in his sleep, lips murmuring, eyelids flexing, and Jutta wills the numbers to climb back up and find their places on her students' exams. She reopens the notebook. Why does a knot hold? That's all the time we have for today. As we've come to the end of the book hour and today's penultimate reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. The preceding program was a production of Sight Into Sound Radio. If 5 cats catch 5 rats in 5 minutes, how many cats will it require to catch 100 rats in 100 minutes? Why does a flag flutter in the wind rather than stand straight out? Tucked between the last 2 pages, she finds an old sealed envelope. He has written, "For Friedrich," across the front. Friedrich, the bunkmate Werner used to write about, the boy who loved birds. He sees what other people don't. What the war did to dreamers. When Albert finally comes up, she keeps her head down and pretends to be grading exams. He peels himself out of his clothes and groans lightly as he gets into bed and switches off his lamp and says good night, and still she sits. We've come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. Preceding program was a production of Sight Into Sound Radio.